So I invite you to sit back, relax, and listen to a reading from John chapter 9. And I invite our readers to come on up front.
As he walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?"
"Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We must work the works of the one who sent me until it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world."
And when he had said this, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes.
"Go, wash in the pool of Siloam."
Then he went and washed and came back, able to see. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "It is he." And others were saying, "No, but it is someone like him." He kept saying,
"I am the man."
But they kept asking him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" And he answered,
"The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' Then I went and washed and received my sight."
And they said to him, "Where is he?" He said,
"I do not know."
They brought him to the Pharisees, the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. And then the Pharisees also began to ask him how he had received his sight. He said to them,
"He put mud on my eyes. Then I washed, and now I see."
Some of the Pharisees said,
"This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath."
But others said,
"How can a man who's a sinner perform such signs?"
And they were divided. So they said again to the blind man,
"What do you say about him? It was your eyes he opened."
"He is a prophet."
The authorities did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them,
"Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?"
His parents answered,
"We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but we do not know how it is that now he sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself."
His parents said this because they were afraid of the authorities, for they had already agreed that anyone who confessed to Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. And therefore his parents said,
"He's of age. Ask him."
So for the second time they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him,
"Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner."
"I do not know whether he is a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see."
"What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?"
"I have told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?"
"You are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from."
"Here is an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but he does listen to one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, He could do nothing.
You were born entirely in sin, and you're trying to teach us?
And they drove him out. Jesus heard that they had driven him out. And when he found him, he said,
"Do you believe in the Son of Man?"
"And who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him."
"You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he."
"Lord, I believe."
And he worshipped him.
Thanks, friend. The uncomfortable question. If any of you have young kids, then it's inevitable that you'll hear them. And you dread it. Especially if the question is asked the way young kids usually ask uncomfortable questions. Loudly, insistently, demanding a simple, understandable answer. For me, the first time was at the Great Escape Amusement Park near Lake George, New York. We were walking around, trying to figure out which rides he was tall enough to ride on, and trying to avoid the tears when he couldn't ride on any of the really good ones. There was a man in a motorized wheelchair operated by a sip and puff straw. And my son saw him. I didn't. But my son saw him, eyes like saucers taking in the strange scene. Now, if it were a TV show, my son would have tugged my arm and I would have bent down and he would have whispered, "Daddy, why is that man in a chair with wheels?" Instead, he lets go of my hand and runs toward the gentleman and starts barraging him with questions. "Are you a robot? How does it work? What is that straw? Can I ride on it? Can it go downstairs?" You probably noticed from the questions that my son was a lot more interested in the chair than he was in the human being that was in it, but that's why he's studying engineering at Northeastern now. Now, you've undoubtedly gotten uncomfortable questions from kids. "Mommy, why can't Grandpa hear me? Daddy, why is that person's skin black? Why is that man sitting on the ground asking for money? Why can't I understand what that person's saying? Why is that man poking around with a white stick?" If you live in a fairly homogeneous culture, kids are going to ask about why some folk are different from them. And sometimes the answer is pretty simple, if tragic. That person's eyes don't work, so he uses a cane to help him get around. Some answers are complex and we don't understand the answers ourselves. How do you talk to a child about systemic racism and white privilege and homelessness and poverty and mental illness when you don't understand how much of those work either? 2,000 years ago, they asked the same difficult questions, but they had a serious theological edge to them because illness and misfortune had moral meaning back then. They were often seen as punishments from God, not just viruses or malfunctioning parts or social injustice or bad stuff just happening. Stuff happens was not a popular saying at the time. The ancient world, quick biology lesson for you, the ancient world understood sight this way. Within each of us is a spiritual lamp that gives off a divine light. And when we open our eyes, that light shines forth and illuminates the world, allowing us to see. Apparently at night, when you were tired, that ability was reduced to allow us to sleep. And the blind, well, the blind had either lost their divine light or they were born without it. And that brings up the moral issue. What had they done to deserve such a punishment? Or what sin had their parents committed for them to deserve such a punishment? In the rabbinic tradition, it was said that the reason some people were born blind was because their parents conceived them sinfully by, for instance, making love shamelessly in the daytime, or shamefully? Shamelessly. How is that the same word? Shameful. But by having sex in the light, their child was punished with darkness and unseeing. And that's why the disciples asked the question the way they did when they asked Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind?" A man born blind would have been assumed to either have been a terrible sinner himself as a child or even in the womb, or he was the children of terrible sinners, which was nearly as bad. The man probably would not have been allowed to be part of a synagogue congregation. And the disciples want to have a philosophical and moral discussion about why this man is the way he is. They want to do a little speculative gossiping about this man's soul. And Jesus doesn't want to have this discussion at all. And he says to them, this is my paraphrase, "It's not about sin, either this man's or his parents." He tells the disciples, "We must do God's work now. That is what his blindness calls us to." And Jesus puts mud on the man's eyes and tells him to wash at the pool of Siloam, and off the blind man obediently goes. Now, we the reader know, because we know who Jesus is, that he'll be healed of his blindness, because that's the way these stories always go in the Gospels. And this man doesn't know Jesus, but he goes in obedience and, I suspect, hope that something might actually happen. The second part of the reading is where it gets kind of Kafka-esque. It's a reminder that in our fallen world, no good deed goes unpunished. A particular group of Sadducees is looking to catch Jesus breaking some religious rules so he can be arrested and stopped from doing what it is that he's doing. Now, I need to write a quick caveat about our reading from John. Pharisees are often depicted in the Gospel of John as snidely whiplash characters. They cackle and twirl their waxed mustaches, or they're seen as preening religious hypocrites. And that is not accurate to who the Pharisees were or how they operated. Pharisees were about how do we live out the will of God in everything we do. And Pharisees were a pretty broad spectrum of folk. Some very conservative, some very liberal. Even within the group of Pharisees depicted here in John's Gospel, they aren't of the same mind about what's going on here. Our Thursday Companions class is learning a lot about the Pharisees. And it's important to remember three things in the reading. One is that Jesus, among all the philosophies or schools of Judaism at the time, Jesus is closer in theological thought to the Pharisees than any other form of Judaism or any other form of any religion. And we're talking here about a particular small group with an axe to grind. And the third thing is that John's gospel was written around the year 100, and it reflects some disagreements that the infant church and the infant rabbinic movement were having as they began to realize that there was a divorce between them imminent. And so the fights that they were having 70 years from this event are kind of overlaid upon them, upon the events here. The scenes with the man born blind and the neighbors and the parents and the Pharisees and Jesus and the back and forth, multiple trips to this bureaucracy of theology, I think are meant to be read as a tragic comedy. Human nature at its best and worst, colliding and colluding. But I'm going to boil it down really quickly because I have some other questions I want us to wrestle with. Part of this story is about sin. How do we talk about sin? How do we see sin? The Pharisees see sin as behaviors or thoughts or words that go beyond an agreed-upon boundary. Talked a little bit last week about bounded communities. The Pharisees had a bounded way of thinking about community. You were in good standing until you acted a certain way, said a certain thing. You were outside the bounds. You were no longer a part of us. You break one of the Ten Commandments, sin. You break one of the 600-some-odd rules of Torah, sin. You break one of the thousands of the laws of oral tradition, sin. Now here, Jesus sinned, in their opinion, because he healed on the Sabbath by kneading mud with a little spit. And kneading bread, ostensibly, it didn't say anything about playing with mud, but kneading was forbidden on the Sabbath, according to the oral tradition. Now, healing is fine and wonderful in Pharisaic thought. It's fine to save a life on the Sabbath, and it's fine to heal anytime. But when they saw this situation, it's a man born blind, a man blind from birth. A healing could wait till tomorrow, right? There was no life needing to be saved here. So he was doing work on the Sabbath in order to heal this man. Now, the ulterior motive, of course, beyond being the sin police in John's gospel, was getting this rabbi who just may bring the Romans down on top of us. This will get him out of the way. He can be declared a sinner. He can be ousted. He's beyond the boundary of what is acceptable thought and action. Now, in John's gospel, sin for Jesus was not about bounded behavior. Sin was about sight, seeing, metaphorical sight and seeing. Sin was not seeing what God was doing even when it was right in front of your eyes. Sin was not recognizing whom God had sent even when he was speaking to you. Sin was mistaking salvation for lostness. Sin was being blind to God's love enfleshed in the person of Jesus, in the healing of the man born blind. And so John's gospel delights throughout in contrast between the one who is physically blind and is healed, or the one who is physically crippled but healed, and those who are spiritually blind and stay that way, or spiritually crippled and stay that way because of closed minds, closed hearts. In John's language, closed eyes. The man born with darkness in this story receives light. And John contrasts it with the religious authorities who claim light and sight but are filled with darkness. The Pharisees in John's gospel suffer from what Stanley Kubrick would call eyes wide shut syndrome. Eyes Wide Shut was a movie from a few years back I haven't had a chance to see it.
It was a horrible movie.
Well, that's what I've seen. That's what I've heard. The reviews were not good, especially from Judy. The only good part I keep hearing about is that you get to see Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman naked a lot. So, you know, if that's important for you, then go ahead. Judy, was it worth it? No, it was not. Okay. Even Judy didn't think that was worth it. So. This is a long reading, and there's 1,000 sermons you can make out of this. But the lesson I think we need to take home today, and I think the one that we're likely to suffer from, is this eyes wide shut syndrome of not seeing what's right in front of us, of God working in places where we don't expect, so we don't see it happening. Sarah Dillon, who has a theology blog, she wrote about a detail I hadn't noticed in this reading before. She writes, "It may be that the most damning point in this Sunday's gospel against Jesus' accusers is one that we easily miss. They did not know the man who was healed." Did you notice all through the story, the Pharisees keep wanting to find out who this guy is? And yet we're told that they see him every day. They walk by him and throw a shekel at the guy. And yet they don't recognize him. Even the neighbors.
Well, it looks kind of like the guy, maybe, we don't know.
They walk by this guy every day, and he's invisible to them. They never see his face. They just see that other, that outsider, that blind guy. They don't see a human being there. They don't see a soul there. They don't see a neighbor there. They don't see part of the community there. The Pharisees don't recognize him when he's walking around and seeing. They don't know who he is. He sat there and begged daily. Every day they walked by him. But when the time came, they couldn't be sure who he was. They'd never talked to him. They never asked him, "Hey, how's your day going? Is there anything else you need? What are your dreams? What do you think about? What's awful about this? What can I do to help?" They had to fetch his parents to give a positive ID. Maybe they only saw him as the darkness they thought was inside him. They only saw him as a social problem indicative of how far our society has sunk. But for whatever reason, they never looked him in the eye. They never really noticed his face. Remember the guy in the wheelchair at Great Escape that my son accosted with his incredibly annoying questions? I ran up to gather my son and apologize for his barrage of rude questions, and the man said haltingly that he didn't mind being asked kids' questions at all. What he did say was, "What I do mind is their parents looking away like I don't exist." And then I realized that I hadn't seen him. I didn't do the overt my eyes and walk around thing like we all do with homeless folk. But I didn't see him. My son did. And that made me think about the homeless guys that I avert my eyes from. And it makes me think today about the refugees I am not putting up in my home, and the reality of life for people who don't have the privileges I have. I've got eyes wide shut syndrome because there's any number of people whose reality I not only don't see, but don't want to know about because it makes me really uncomfortable. Because it forces me to ask the uncomfortable questions that usually only kids are willing to ask. Eyes wide shut syndrome is another word for social privilege. The ability to go through life without having to see anyone else's predicament. I mean, ultimately, privilege is about never having to think about somebody else's reality. I am a healthy, able-bodied, white, cisgendered, heterosexual male with a postgraduate degree, with a job he loves, in a marriage that has blessed him for almost 30 years, with two amazing kids in college, a roof over my head, health insurance, and an incredibly patient, generous, and forgiving community of faith that puts up with a lot. I've got two ways of dealing with that. I can be over my head, jumping up and down, grateful for it, thanking God and my people every moment I can. Or I can tell myself that I earned all this. I deserve this. After all, I can accurately say that I worked hard in school. I work hard at my job. My daddy grew up on a Depression-era Kansas dirt farm, and he sacrificed himself and his family to 25 years in the military. I can say I work hard on my marriage. I work hard to eat right and exercise and keep healthy and all that. All that I can talk all day about how much I deserve and worked hard for what I have. And that makes some amazing assumptions. That the folks I'm averting my eyes from don't work hard. That everyone else could have what I have if they worked hard. And if they don't have what I have, it's because they probably are morally suspect. Maybe they're lazy. Maybe they don't work hard. Maybe they're just not smart. Maybe. But the reality is, as I'm unpacking that backpack full of privilege I have, I don't deserve any of those things. Those are all special boosts I got. Being white, being cisgendered, being heterosexual, being male, being this, being that. I have a lot of privileges. Now I'm not here to, oh, I feel guilty about these. I'm not going to feel guilty about them, but I need to be aware of them. And I need to put myself in a place where I'm aware of others, of other people's non-privileges. But to do that, I have to get out and put myself into uncomfortable places. That's the thing about eyes wide shut syndrome, is if I just hang out where I'm comfortable, I don't have to see anything I don't like to see. But every once in a while, I find myself seeing a situation that makes me aware. When I was in seminary, and a dozen ROTC students came running after me saying I should be killed because I fit their stereotype of what a gay man looks like. And I thought, oh my gosh, is this what gay and lesbian folks deal with every day? I've shared this before, but when I got stopped by a police officer because I had a black parishioner in the passenger seat with me, Does this happen a lot? Pastor, yes. Walking downtown with a transgendered parishioner and seeing the scowls and the disapprovals, I was withering in two blocks. I said, Danielle, what is this? She's, yeah, every moment of every day. When I hear the horror stories of a Christian brother growing up in a refugee camp in Sudan, or a folk I know getting turned away at the border because they're of Indian descent. Of refugees I've met who talk about their being put on a death squad hit list. Of a friend who was raped by her OBGYN. Of a woman whose job is in jeopardy because she had to bring her daughter to a mental health clinic. Here's the privileged part. Here's the eyes wide shut part. I don't have to experience any of that. I can walk into a store, and if the owner is staring at me funny, I can assume it's because my fly is open. And not because she thinks I'm going to steal something. If someone flips me off in traffic, I can assume it's because I did some knuckleheaded move without my blinkers on. I don't have to always be thinking, is that because I fit this category? This is the privileged part. I don't have to experience any of that if I don't want to. I don't have to listen to the stories of people who hurt. I don't have to ask the difficult questions. For us. The Pharisees never looked at the man who was born blind. They never saw him as a human being. And they never had to ask the tough questions, or they could just assume they knew the answers to the question of why was this man born blind? He sinned or his parents sinned. It's pretty easy to operate like that. I have homework for y'all on your insert on the bottom of the page of Lenten Questions, week 4. I want us to take time this week to think about our eyes being wide shut, to ask yourselves, what are the ways I walk around with my eyes wide shut? Who is invisible to me? That's a tough question because I don't know who's invisible to me. I need to think about it. What do I not see because I think I have it figured out? Where is God working that I haven't noticed? Is there something God is doing in the world that I consider sin? If that last question sounds a little weird, let me think of some examples. A generation before I was in seminary, when there were women in seminary, women getting ordained, women going into the ministry, a majority of people calling themselves Christians said that was the devil working, not God working. Just as the Pharisees, seeing Jesus healing in the wrong way, said, this is the devil working. This is not God working. Is there something God is doing in this world that I might be mistaken in seeing, thinking it's sin? The point of this sermon is not, oh wow, look at the Pharisees, what bad people they are. Aren't we enlightened? It's about holding up a mirror of the difficult questions that kids ask and ask them of ourselves. to get lenses through which we might be able to see a little better the world. Lenses of people who don't look like me or act like me or think like me. So that that divine light in us might illuminate the world for Christ and through Christ. Amen.